Welcome to the First Assist Podcast. I'm your host, Taylor Goodstein, and my guest this week is Dr. Kamal Pohar, who is Associate Professor of Urology at The Ohio State University, and one of my mentors from when I was there at Ohio State. He's also an expert in bladder cancer, which is perfect for our topic today, which is going to be discussing the historical context in the management and surveillance for non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, because as we know, it's changed quite drastically over the last 50 years and continues to do so. So thanks for being here, Dr. Pohar.
Appreciate the invitation, Dr. Goodstein.
I think what really becomes interesting is setting the stage for when in 1976, the first kind of BCG paper came out. So could you tell us what up until that point had been being done for intravesical therapy in bladder cancer?
Yeah, I certainly haven't been in practice, that dates back to that era. I kind of worked in the era where BCG had been the standard of care for more than two decades. But the reality is that intravesical therapy had a fairly strong footprint in the realm of managing recurrences in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. A number of different chemotherapeutics had been tested over time and had demonstrated some benefit, that administration of intravesical therapies with the class of agents of chemotherapeutics was beneficial in reducing recurrence rates. So therapies had been around by that delivery method, mostly chemotherapy-based, with some proven benefit.
And, one of the notes that Morales makes in that paper is that the antigenicity of bladder tumors had been well established, suggesting that immune therapy was going to be a good idea. But I've never really understood where the leap between it being, needing an immune therapy and using like the tuberculosis vaccine, like where that came from. So do you have any insight into that?
Yeah, I'll share with my knowledge of how that came about. So certainly, I think the story goes back to a time in the early 20th century where autopsy studies had demonstrated that individuals affected by the world pandemic or endemic of tuberculosis, those individuals had a lower incidence of cancer documented on autopsy studies. And I think there was some knowledge even during clinical lifetime of individuals who had had active tuberculosis didn't seem to be affected by cancer as often. And so the autopsy studies had driven that message to a, or driven that knowledge to a level that was, had more foundation. So there was some principle there. And I think we all know the story about Coley's toxin, knowing that, other immunogenic agents, in this case bacterial agents, that individuals who had sepsis or were active bacterial infections also seemed to have a lower incidence of cancer. And Coley's toxin was developed to actually inject individuals, possibly induce sepsis. Of course, there were some really negative consequences and death from having done that. But those who were fortunate enough to survive the infectious insult, there were individuals had had regression of cancer. So I think this principle had been around for a while. And then due to a series of circumstances, it wasn't explored anymore and the science went quiet. And so there's a story behind that that led some bad events and death of some children. There was some negativity about this. I think the story picks up again at one point. Dr. Old at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, a researcher, started to investigate tuberculosis in the lab with syngeneic mouse models and was pre-sensitizing animals and exposing them to tuberculosis and demonstrating that models of cancer development in mice, there was less penetration and less development of cancer when they had been exposed to tuberculosis. And then the story moves to the NCI, where Burton Zabar did some of the some of the first work, again, with tuberculosis and cancer. And so the story started to evolve scientifically in the lab and animal models, first from a story of human observations to actually some experimental work in laboratories demonstrating that. And then I think some of the first clinical uses of it were injection of a melanoma lesion with TB vaccine, but some regression. A CLL patient was treated with the tuberculosis vaccine with regression of disease. So there were clinical anecdotes of almost malignancies before Dr. Morales actually went about doing a small series of bladder cancer patients. So I think the story, you know, evolved from different observations, and then someone who really embraced and kind of took the situation at hand and really decided they would study some patients, obviously led to the two fundamental NCI randomized trials that were done. As soon as Dr. Morales published his paper, the SWOG group did a randomized trial. The Memorial Sloan Kettering group did a trial, NCI-supported trials, and that changed the field of bladder cancer care.
Yeah, that is so interesting. I do not know about those observations with tuberculosis. And I'd imagine that, like, giving intravenous BCG, bad idea in terms of that sepsis risk, but the bladder, you know, obviously presents a very unique site of cancer that can be very easily accessed from, you know, outside to instill these agents, and hopefully with limited, because the bladder is so inert, you know, limited systemic uptake. So let's talk, can we talk a little bit more about the trials that you mentioned? I think one of those is maybe SWOG 8507.
I don't recall the details that well. But certainly, you know, there are randomized trials looking at administering intravesical BCG. I don't remember what the control arm was in the trials, and clearly demonstrated, you know, reduced recurrence rates. One of the trials had an arm of intradermal injection as well, you know, to try to prime the therapy. It kind of lost, you know, the trial did not demonstrate an additive benefit to the intradermal component of it. And it, so it lost its favor, but through a series of knowledge that developed over time, I'll term it as recent knowledge, it led to an instrumental trial that just got completed in the United States, and we're anxiously awaiting the results of that trial. And that's a trial that was comparing two different strains of BCG. One of the arms of that three-arm trial was adding the intradermal injection to one of the strains of BCG that's being tested against the BCG strain that's available today, the Merck strain in the United States. And again, it's bringing back science. It's kind of nice that we don't always accept a result of a study. Sometimes, you know, for different reasons, studies can provide negative results or indeterminate results. And you know, we draw large conclusions and feel that we have the knowledge that there's no benefit. But, you know, additional scientific studies started to demonstrate that there could potentially be benefit. And so there was a recent trial, again, that was concluded that's now looked at, you know, is that priming effect is potentially beneficial. And so we anxiously await the results of that randomized SWOG trial, which we should know about in the next year or two.
That's great. I was actually wondering about that, because the original Morales paper, they did give like intradermal BCG as well. And then I read a couple other early studies where they were doing it, and then they just seemed to like stop, you know. So the context for why they stopped, and, you know, it's good to know that there's still some curiosity there if there could be a benefit. You know, I'd always heard a rumor in residency that the reason why BCG induction is once a week for 6 weeks is because there were like exactly 6 vials in the case. Do you know if that's true or not?
Yeah, so I think certainly from the source, Dr. Morales himself, you know, not only has he verbalized that, but I think it's even written in a number of articles he's written over the years on the topic of why he decided to do this and how the field has changed. So I think there is a lot of truth to that story about why six doses are done. And somewhat surprisingly, that's the regimen for pretty much any intravesical therapy. You know, everybody seems to follow that regimen, even some of the novel, newer agents. But tested in different spaces of bladder cancer, you know, we're all very comfortable with that 6 weekly schedule and can't seem to let that go.
Okay. And then about the, and then the maintenance schedule, you know, kind of also a random, you know, you break for 3 months and then you do 3 weeks, you know, once a week. Does that have anything to do with what we know about how the BCG, you know, how the response, you know, maybe the immune system response maybe attenuates over time? Or was that just kind of something that was done just because?
Well, I think there is some knowledge about why the maintenance schedule was designed the way it was. Now, you know, the strength of the knowledge, certainly, you know, I think we can build on that and maybe try, you know, that may evolve over time. But there were measurements of serum cytokines, various cytokine profiles that were done to measure, you know, activation of immunity. And this was in the sera. And there was a point in time where the limited studies that were done looking at this methodology, where you have a peaking of the cytokine response. And at that point thereafter, you have a dissipation of different cytokine profiles. Not every marker goes down, but the overall context is you reach a peak point, and maybe you don't get the added benefit of continuing to add further doses. So that's where the three-dose regimen came from. And again, it's from a limited studies of detecting profiles in the sera and making determinations in terms of, you know, why is it the schedule 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. You know, I think that was based on preclinical models and clinical judgment about why that was developed. And that really hasn't been tested with any rigor against other schedules. But I think, you know, our general feeling is on the analyses that have been done, there are other maintenance cycles of BCG that have been utilized worldwide. Some of them are monthly, some of them are bi-monthly, some of them have other schema. Again, they've never really been tested against one another. The scientific validity of each of the regimens probably is not that robust. But the knowledge that we have and those who have gone back and looked at the data, the consensus really is, I think we all feel the SWOG protocol of maintenance delivery is probably the one that gives the best results based on our current knowledge of what's available to us. So I think that's the one that I utilize. It's the one that's in the guidelines and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So I think residents also sometimes struggle with understanding the surveillance schedule of cystoscopy, which if a patient is getting maintenance BCG, it follows pretty perfectly, you know, like usually right before you would start the next treatment. But then it's still the similar schedule if a patient's not getting therapy. So is that because the surveillance schedule was based off of the maintenance schedule, or did those two things kind of develop independently?
You know, so the surveillance cystoscopy schedule, the current approach we use is pretty much unchanged, you know, for an extensive period of time. I think that's an important concept you bring up. There's the therapeutic component of the intravesical therapy. You know, why are you using it? In a given patient, it has different principles depending on the background of their cancer diathesis about why you're using intravesical therapy. But then there's the important component of wanting to always have knowledge at various intervals. Is the individual free of cancer recurrence or cancer response? And so they're separate entities, but you do need to coordinate them in terms of the care plan. And so I think there's quite a bit of integration. Now, in a textbook, you know, it looks real perfect in diagrams about where the cystoscopies are and the treatments are given exactly on these weeks. But in real world practice, you know, it doesn't synchronize as cleanly as that. And the schedule can get a little bit off. It's not exactly at week 16, you do this, and week 19, you'll do this. You know, those weeks can kind of drag out a little bit. But it's important. It's important that there's a plan of action of documenting that the individual doesn't have cancer recurrence. Now, certainly, you know, we may be over evaluating and over exposing individuals to an invasive procedure in the office to survey their bladder. And, you know, the nice thing is there has been risk stratification of how often cystoscopy should be done based on your category of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. So we're doing less than we used to, that's for sure. But certainly, I think one could debate the fact that are we still doing too many surveillance cystoscopies when you look at the high risk and the intermediate risk population? You know, are we still doing too many? And the answer is probably we are. But I think both components are really important, that there's integration and there's principles about, you know, why you're doing the two and what the value is of the two.
Okay. At around the same time that the BCG maintenance, you know, SWOG paper was being published, there was also an establishment of doing a repeat TUR for T1 tumors. And I believe that was Henry Herr's paper where he talked about that and the findings there.
Yeah, so I think Dr. Herr at Memorial Sloan Kettering, you know, did a lot to develop the knowledge about how often there's residual disease in the bladder following a TURBT. But certainly, I think there were reports that existed prior to that, you know, small reports throughout the literature that the operation is not foolproof, that residual disease is a possibility. Dr. Herr, you know, certainly established that at a level where the message was very clear that the amount of residual disease was probably considerably more than many might have suggested based on their own experience or your opinion about how often residual disease is left behind. Now, you know, I think it varies in different contexts about how often the potential possibility of residual disease is left behind. A lot of Dr. Herr's publications are based on a tertiary referral center, and the original publications, at least. And it's very hard to know when there may be a referral bias about was the initial TURBT complete, or was it the fact that there was too much volume to manage at the surgery and there's known residual disease, there's grossly known residual disease. So it's hard to really interpret, you know, based on the original publications, that if there's real intent to remove all signs of cancer at their first surgery, how often is there truly microscopic residual cancer? Certainly, it's far from zero. I think that's the message. You know, over the years, there are numerous publications now on this similar topic. I'm looking at residual disease rates, and mostly focused on T1 bladder cancer. You know, we have evidence for other types as well, but T1 is where the majority of the literature is. I think one thing we can agree on is that certainly there is residual cancer, and those rates are not in the single digits. Uh-huh. So, you know, there is, you do have to have some worry and caution, and the guidelines certainly counsel you and I that we should be performing a repeat TURBT in certain contexts of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, and T1 bladder cancer is at the top of the list when we should almost invariably be doing a repeat TURBT.
Okay. Is there, you know, I remember in residency you telling me that in a busy clinical practice, you know, you have to prioritize certain higher risk groups of patients for things like repeat TUR. You can't do it on everybody. Is there any, besides that T1 cohort, is there any other patient population that you feel really benefits from doing that?
Yeah, I think we should lean on the AUA guideline. And okay. The AUA guidelines states that the following populations would benefit. So the first one, I think, you know, we'll kind of get off the board quickly. A very straightforward one is if there's known residual disease left behind, and there's intent to save the bladder, that the final plan of action is you want to save the bladder in the end. So you will go back and you will eradicate all signs of visible papillary disease. And so I think if there's known residual disease, you will for certain go back. And mm-hmm. that's important that you do that. And even if it takes you a third operation and there's value in doing that, you will do everything you can systematically to remove the papillary disease and cure that. So that's one category. The second one is the T1 bladder cancer, completely resected with or without the presence of muscularis propria in the resection. We're obligated to go back and do a repeat TURBT. That's a grade B recommendation by the AUA. The third category, which is a grade C recommendation, which doesn't have as much tight boundaries, is multifocal high-grade TA bladder cancer. I think there you need to use some judgment, you know, about the individual has some leeway to determine in your best judgment how confident are you that all signs of cancer were removed, and are you confident the patient was adequately staged? So larger volume tumor, so more in number, larger tumors, difficult location to reach in the bladder, absence of muscularis propria. You know, these are factors that probably persuade you more towards considering a repeat TURBT as opposed to being comfortable that you removed all signs of disease and you're ready for the next step in bladder cancer care. So I think those are the three that one has to come to mind about a repeat TURBT, where its benefit is.
You know, when we're talking about kind of accurately resecting as, you know, as much tumor, trying to get full visible resection, I think about this technology, this fancy technology that came around in 2005, hexaminolevulinate acid, got it, or aka blue light Cysview, or if you're in Europe, it's hexfix or something like that.
I'll just call it HAL.
Okay, perfect. So that comes around in 2005. Now, where are you in your training in that at that time, if you want to reveal your secret?
Well, you know, I had the good fortune of having been a faculty member for several years. When the instrumental trial was done, that led to FDA approval. So as you referenced, the technology was available in Europe far sooner than it became available in the United States. And to be honest, I was not overly aware of the technology, that it was being utilized in another continent, and that there was quite an abundant amount of medical evidence that supported the use of blue light cystoscopy in conjunction with a fluorescent agent that improves detection of bladder cancer, and some reports that demonstrated not only does it improve detection, but it reduces recurrence rates. So the instrumental trial done that led to the FDA approval, that was somewhere around 2010 or so, if my memory is right. So soon thereafter at our institution, within 2 or 3 years of that conclusion of the trial and soon thereafter FDA approval, you know, we had that at our institution. So it's a technology that I would say I grew up my faculty career with side by side. There was a short period of time as a faculty member where the technology wasn't available in the United States, but you know, it's a routine part of my practice, and I utilize it extensively because of the fact the medical evidence is clear that, like a lot of enhanced cystoscopy technologies, not just blue light alone, there's increased in tumor detection. So that's the starting point, is that enhanced cystoscopies, blue light, NBI, and so forth, they increase the visualization of tumors that you might miss with white light cystoscopy. But I think maybe more importantly, from a patient perspective, there's a primary outcome that's maybe more meaningful to a patient, that it reduces their early term recurrence rates, that over the shorter medium term, recurrence rates are lower. So that's always a really rewarding endpoint. That means less surgeries. If you have less recurrences, less exposure to surgeries, and nobody wants surgery. And so, I think the strength of the evidence is pretty clear that the technology increases detection, reduces recurrence rates. There's no evidence conclusively that it reduces progression rates and other variables that you look at with any degree of strong foundational knowledge. There's pockets of information that's suggestive that other variables are improved too, but the ones that have the strength of evidence are the detection and reducing recurrence rate.
So I know you use HAL regularly in your practice. Did you ever at any point use narrowband imaging when that technology came around?
Yeah, we did. We were also fortunate that the scopes that we had purchased over different eras of my time being at my current institution, that NBI technology was available both on our flexible cystoscopes in the office. And there was a point where our resectoscopes actually had NBI technology. Well, we had the camera for that as well in the operating room. And so when we had the capability, we were certainly utilizing it because NBI clearly demonstrates that there's increased detection rates of cancer from a number of studies that have been done. So that's conclusive there as well. But one thing I certainly would say is that NBI, it does not have a grade B recommendation from the AUA, but rather a grade C recommendation, because the strength of the evidence does not conclusively demonstrate that it reduces recurrence rates. And it may impact low-grade non-invasive tumors more in reducing recurrence rates than the higher-grade tumors. The studies suggest that the impact in reducing recurrence rates may be more in the low-grade non-invasive population. But certainly it improves detection rates. So if NBI is available to an individual, if you have it available to you in whatever setting you're doing cystoscopy, whether it's in the clinic or the operating room, I certainly think you should use it. And there's always an advantage to using it. And it's very simple, as you know. It's just pressing a button in that circumstance. You don't have to do it by adding an agent to utilize the technology.
I think if you're early in your training, it's done by accidentally pushing a button, I'm pretty sure is the appraisive correct way. But it does have that benefit of, the patient's not needing to come in early and get the intravesical agent administered and pre-op and all the, kind of maybe the coordination that comes along with that, which leads me back to kind of HAL and wanting to ask you, in 2018, the FDA expanded the recommendation for blue light to use in clinic for your flexible cystoscopy. And I was wondering if you'd incorporated that into your practice.
We haven't. And, the study that was done to lead to the approval of the agent not only being useful in the operating room when you're therapeutically managing bladder cancer, but now move it to the office setting where it's about detection and surveillance. So the study was really randomizing patients, the same patient to both white light cystoscopy, not really, I take back the term randomizing, I'm sorry, I'm going to go back on my terminology. It was really looking with white light cystoscopy and then flipping the button and going to blue light cystoscopy, and the agent had been administered at least 60 minutes before the procedure, and then reevaluating the patient and seeing, are there additional lesions you detected or are there lesions you might have missed with blue light cystoscopy? It's important to recognize the two technologies are complementary. And then the study ended up concluding that a certain percentage of patients had increased detection of cancer proven by biopsy. It was mostly carcinoma in situ of the patients where there was increased detection proven in the operating room. It was carcinoma in situ. But it is a pretty large denominator of patients you have to do flexible cystoscopy on in the office. And these were all high-risk NMIBC patients that were included in the trial. So that's what it evaluated. And there's a very large, there's quite a large denominator to get the small, to get of patients.
And
so, yeah. So it's a relatively small number of patients who had the additive benefit. And then it was a detection trial. So there's no further outcome, you know, that did it truly reduce recurrence, progression, long term. And so, you know, we know it, the detection rate was better.
Okay.
And so I'll kind of leave it at that. So that's the benefit. And then, you know, from a cost effective, from a cost effective analysis, from a time commitment analysis, you know, everyone has to make their own decisions in your own environment. When you put all of that together, you know, is there truly benefit for the small number of patients who are going to benefit by that increased detection? So we haven't done that at our institution. We've certainly gone through the numbers and looked at it. How valuable would that be in a large bladder cancer practice program of many individuals, you know, in our institution focused on the care of bladder cancer patients? And we just have felt that when we put all those variables together, it's probably not in the best interest doing it. No, there are others that have purchased it in their clinic setting. There's differences of evaluations and judgment on what you think the benefit might be.
My consideration of it was always just considering what that added burden that might be for the patient. You know, they're already coming in getting cystos so frequently for the diagnosis of bladder cancer. Now you add like an extra hour or so onto their visit every time. I'd imagine that burden is not insubstantial as well.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point. And that trial was the very first surveillance cystoscopy. So that knowledge was about the very first cystoscopy. So if you're a purist by the trial data, you know, that is the absolute include, that's the absolute inclusion criteria, which we talked about, and the methodology of the study. So it was the very first follow-up cystoscopy is the only time that that agent was utilized in that study to garner that knowledge. So, you know, I think that's kind of where the data is.
Got it. So that's like your first like 3 month cysto, but not at the subsequent ones. Okay, got it. Interesting. So along with kind of other technologies that we have to detect bladder cancer in clinic, obviously cytology is something that's been around for a very, very long time. I think it was like the 1940s. It's actually, I did not know this, but Dr. Papanikolaou, this guy of the pap smear, he was also the person looking at tumor cells in the urine and discovered that in like 1945. But we got a little fancier in 2005 with Eurovision FISH. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and whether or not you use that in your practice, and how you use it.
Sure. I think talking about biomarkers is always important, you know, in the care of bladder cancer patients. I'm going to make one comment about urine cytology, I think, to get us started. You know, the cytology literature has kind of been all over the place, you know, over the years in terms of the sensitivity and specificity and the positive and negative predictive value of the marker. I think one important advance about cytology that we should all be aware of is the Paris consensus classification. So I don't recall the exact year, but it's been 6-7 years now since the Paris consensus group met. So it's really an effort by cytopathologists of getting together and defining criteria and using very specific terminology that when you're evaluating a cytology, that these are the criteria that you should be looking at, and these are the four categories in which how you should classify a cytologic sample, from all the way from being presence of high-grade urothelial cancer cells all the way down to negative, and then in between the suspicious and the atypical urothelial cell category. In the past, the atypical category, a very frustrating category, used to dominate the percentage of cytology samples. Many of them were predominantly reported as atypical and created room in clinical practice. The consensus classification has really helped because that category has really narrowed considerably, that we're not in the conundrum of atypical cytologies that often. And so suspicious and positive always draw our attention that likely, almost certainly, we need to proceed further with additional evaluation. And the negative category is the negative category. And so I think this has been a really helpful advance. I think it's allowed for the performance characteristics of cytology to be better. It's very focused on the high-grade non-muscle invasive bladder cancer population is where cytology has really focused its intent now and where the Paris consensus classification has focused its intent. So Eurovision FISH was in an era of maybe I'll use the term a little more ambiguity about cytology interpretation, language being reported back to the clinician and you're interpreting, you know, how should I proceed with this cytology result? I'm gonna go back to the AUA guidelines so you get a sense. You know, I love the guidelines. I think the guidelines are a really a wonderful effort that helps all of us as practitioners. There's a lot of effort behind various guidelines and various organizations that put forward information for us and collate it for us. The AUA guideline, that's how I practice using Eurovision FISH. So in circumstances where you feel like you need to adjudicate an abnormal cytology result. And there are various circumstances where that might come up in clinical practice where you feel like you have a result or you have a lesion in the bladder by cystoscopy and your cytology is negative, but you saw something that made you worry and you, so an endoscopic finding or a cytologic finding where you feel you might need to adjudicate it. I think Eurovision FISH is helpful in that setting that it can help you maybe make a clinical decision with more confidence and build confidence with a patient relationship sometimes. There's also evidence that suggests that a nice study done by a group of investigators in the United States, a prospective, more recent study looking at Eurovision FISH to assess BCG response. So in situations of a high-risk bladder cancer patient who receives induction BCG therapy, that first follow-up, sometimes the cystoscopic findings can be a little difficult to interpret with a lot of therapy effect and so forth. The cytology may come back suspicious or atypical. The study suggested there could be some value in maybe better determining response to BCG therapy by adding Eurovision FISH. And so those are two settings, you know, where I think one should certainly consider it. I don't use it much at all in the setting of evaluating BCG response. Certainly, I will use it far more when I feel there's a need to adjudicate and I don't want to just rush someone to an operating room to do a biopsy of a lesion. So that I think that's the current view of Eurovision FISH as a biomarker, and that's what the AUA guideline suggests. There's a lot of biomarkers now, though, that are being tested. There's various levels of data, various levels of publication, you know, that are looking at more of a global profile of the cell as opposed to a single protein marker, or in the case of Eurovision FISH, for genetic or chromosomal marks in the cell. And so, you know, expression profile, looking at epigenetic profiles of the entire cell, merging profiles of mRNA and epigenetics. So, you know, there's a lot of robust technologies trying to expand, you know, the world of biomarkers. And so I think the future is bright. I don't think there's anything conclusive right now that there's a biomarker that will that currently replaces cytology. But I think the future is bright and hopefully there will be new breakthroughs.
I think there's one big area of kind of the historical context that we haven't completely touched on yet. And, you know, we've been throwing around these words, high risk, intermediate risk, low risk, these risk categorizations for non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, which didn't, you know, come out of thin air. The AUA and EUA recommendations were built on a couple of different models. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think being very knowledgeable about these risk groups, I think it really brings confidence to a practitioner. It allows you to take your patient when you have information about the clinical characteristics of the cancer that you ascertained when you were in the operating room and maybe at the surveillance cystoscopy that led to going to the operating room, where you characterized the disease state. How many tumors were there? What was the size of the tumor? Where were they located? What was the phenotypic configuration of the tumor and so forth? When you have that information available, and in addition to that, you now have the pathology from the TURBT. So you have clinical factors, pathologic factors, and you want to be able to know, and the patient wants to know, what's the chances that I'm cured? What's the chance my tumor will recur? What's the chance my tumor might come back and it'll be worse than what my current state is? And so, you know, we really need to understand this well to provide good care. And so breaking down non-muscle invasive bladder cancer into three risk categories, low risk, intermediate risk, and high risk, I think is really valuable, because what those terms mean is they are actually imply a lesser or a greater risk of subsequent tumor recurrence or disease progression. And so there are clinical and pathologic factors on multivariate analyses from a number of studies that demonstrate that there are certain factors that have a higher risk of recurrence and progression than other factors do. And so they are the number of tumors in the bladder, the size of tumors in the bladder, what was your prior how often have you developed bladder cancers in the past? So have you had recurrences in less than 1 year, more than 1 year? Pathologic factors of what's the T stage of the cancer? Was there carcinoma in situ present or not? And the grade of the cancer. If you put those factors together, that's how the categories are built: low, intermediate, and high risk. So those are the factors that come together to build those categories. Other factors are then added to that, and that includes: have you had prior BCG exposure? Do you respond? Do you have components of bladder cancer that are not just the histology of urothelial cancer, but do you have variants of urothelial cancer? Is there lymphovascular invasion in the primary tumor? Did the pathologist document that on the pathology report? So, you know, there are additive factors that you can add to those categories. And again, they're all in the guidelines. They're in the AUA guidelines. They're in the European guidelines. But importantly, they allow us to determine what the risk of recurrence and progression are of that given state of bladder cancer. And then they help direct you to, does this individual need intravesical therapy to reduce those risks? And if so, what are the options of the agents that you could consider? And also, what should the surveillance cystoscopy schedule be, what we were talking about before? So those risk categories really help you and I to knowing, should we give intravesical therapy? What should that agent be? And how often should we be doing surveillance cystoscopies?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there was the one risk table, the EORTC risk table, I think was the first one of those models to come out in the early 2000s. And its big critique was it was kind of pre-BCG, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, very true. Okay. Yeah. Unfortunately, I think that's kind of the largest reason why that wonderful effort of over 2,500 patients that were acquired through various clinical trials, and so the data was quite robust and not on those patients having been enrolled on clinical trials, but the patients really were devoid of BCG therapy, standard of care for the majority of people today in various states of bladder cancer. So the usefulness of that tool is relatively limited in modern day practice.
Mm-hmm. And then kind of in response to that, I think a little bit later, there were the Queto models that came out, and it was a combination of, you know, data from that and EORTC that led to what we have now as our modern kind of risk stratification. Is that?
I think, yeah, the Queto tables, I think, too, were another important effort. It was very focused on the Spanish population, the Spanish population. And So the factors were fairly similar between the ERTC risk tables, but there were different factors that came up on the analysis in Quato, including gender and age were additional factors that were delineated that impacted recurrence rates. There are some reasons why the Quato tables are not generalizable worldwide. You know, there's or endemic exposure to TB in the Spanish population or tuberculosis. So there may be different responses to BCG. Some of the trials were done with, I think, 1/3 dose BCG versus full dose BCG. And so there are some caveats related to the Quato tables and why they're not universally used or not used in clinical practice. But both of those efforts, I think, were really important investments of a lot of good energy and a lot of thought to do something objective to really help our patients. Unfortunately, neither of those tools are very relevant to us in clinical practice today because they're overestimating risks of recurrence and progression, but still, useful knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're almost up to modern day. I did want to discuss very briefly, the use of perioperative chemotherapy and what role that plays, where that evidence came from for non-muscle invasive disease.
I don't really know when the thought came about, mm-hmm. when, the concept of, well, why don't we give a drug and could it be safe right after we do a TURBT or soon thereafter a TURBT? But that concept has had traction in medical practice and clinical practice for many, many years. It's at least 20, 30 years ago that that perioperative dose of therapy was administered. During the course of my career, who benefits from that agent has changed. And so there was a point in time when one of the most instrumental meta-analyses came about in the early 2000s from the EORTC that suggested from that high-level meta-analysis that every single patient in whom it was suspected the TURBT was on the basis of a non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, in the clinician's judgment that I think this is non-muscle invasive bladder cancer is likely what the final pathology will be, that everybody would benefit from that perioperative dose of chemotherapy. And so, we were giving it a lot at that time. Mm-hmm. But as time went on, a number of additional clinical trials and studies were done. And it's again a concept we brought up earlier in our discussion today. It's good to get information, it's good to have advances, but it's not good to accept things, exclusively that we can't continue to learn and get better. So despite the fact that, our approach was to give the therapy in every patient after a TURBT, the evidence has changed over time. So today, where the evidence really is there's no doubt every low-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer patient benefits. Almost certainly the majority of intermediate risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer patients benefit. From the standpoint of a purist, if you want to count numbers, the ERTC tables, they have point scores. So anybody that's less than 5 points, so if you go to those ERTC tables, each of those six categories we discussed, you can assign points to each of those categories. And so you can assign a number. You can add up those six numbers and you can come up with a final score. If that score is less than 5, the individual benefits from that perioperative single dose of chemotherapy within the first 24 hours. If your point score is higher, you probably don't benefit because you're going to go on to further induction intravesical therapy. So that's the way I view it in my practice. A very straightforward approach is low risk, intermediate risk patients benefit. Why don't we always try to do that in that patient population? The high risk population does not benefit and we won't administer it in that setting. So the data has changed over time. I think that's where the current knowledge is about in whom to give it and what chemotherapeutic agent. I don't think it matters much, although gemcitabine is the one that certainly has the greatest favor right now. But there's no doubt you can use any chemotherapeutic agent that you desire as a single dose. But the toxicity profile is why gemcitabine is maybe favored over, other agents.
Like mitomycin.
Like mitomycin.
Yeah. I think a lot of modern non-muscle invasive bladder cancer management has been really overshadowed a lot by the BCG shortage. And that's led to, you know, I think a lot of practice changes. I just wanted to, you know, get your input on like where that shortage came from, why that's been such a problem, and how that's affected the care that we give.
Yeah, it's a big issue. It's kind of a shame that affects patient care. You know, we're so engaged by BCG for good reason. You know, it has great value and impact in our bladder cancer patients. It's not perfect. Unfortunately, people still recur despite receiving adequate BCG, but it is a very valuable therapeutic advance that we have in practice. So the fact that, you know, various parts of the country are going through shortages, and it's kind of on again, off again in different regions. And so, but there's a silver lining in it, I guess. You know, we have to look for positive sometimes in situations that are difficult. And the positive is the fact that, you know, we've become very enthusiastic about testing new agents where BCG is the standard of care. If you don't have access to BCG, well, we need to have alternatives. And so there are a number, you know, there's trials being done looking at different agents in the space where BCG would be commonly administered. And so it's given us opportunities to investigate new approaches, new agents. So I think there is a silver lining in this is, you know, hopefully we will have new drugs and BCG will not be the only drug that we lean on.
Do you think that in other countries they're using recombinant BCG? Is that something that you see becoming more adopted in the United States?
I think it's an interesting concept. You know, I'm not an expert in modifying bacteria or viruses and, you know, changing the genome. It's not my scientific thrust or expertise, but, you know, I think certainly you can modify biologic agents and you can increase their immunogenicity. And so there are various ways to do that. And so that's what this effort is, a recombinant BCG therapy, is to modify the construct, take away some aspects of it, potentially like the bacterial cell wall, other components of the bacterium, to reduce some of its antigenicity of agents that maybe are affecting immunogenicity in a negative way, and finding other ways to build the immunogenicity to the agent. So I think, you know, I certainly am aware of a couple of the reports that you reference. You know, I think there's been a couple of a nice phase two trial that was done in Europe recently. Certainly we need to see the robust evidence. You know, we see stronger level evidence. We need to see a phase three clinical trial that is powered to look at this. But I certainly think it makes a lot of sense. It's one way to potentially move forward and away from our current BCG need to a different way that maybe we can move forward by having other agents in the space, and maybe better agents in the space, and recombinant technology might be one way forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're all caught up. It's a whirlwind. I mean, just to, before we sign off, just curious what, you know, if there's anything you're really looking forward to now that we've covered all the old research and old technology that has been developed and has been worked on in order to get us to where we are. What are you excited about that's coming up?
I think one thing for our learners that we should probably make a comment about: the TURBT operation is very difficult. So I think everybody should recognize that. Don't be discouraged, when you're doing the operation and you're learning, or you even have some experience, it's a physically and mentally challenging operation. So TURBT is a difficult surgery. And there is quite a bit of focus in the urology world that we're looking at ways of how can each of us get better at the operation. And so I like the fact that there is focus of ways that we can get better. Some of it is scorecards, some of it is simulators that aren't very good, but they're in development trying to get them better, you know, to do better operations. And there's intraoperative reporting of skills and immediate feedback to learners and ways you can get better. So, you know, there's a lot of tools and ways to develop that. The technologies in this area need to get better. And so, there hasn't been a lot of effort in getting resectoscopes and TURBT technology much better. It hasn't changed much over the years. Sure, visualization has gotten better, cameras are better, resolution is better, but the actual physical conduct of the operation hasn't changed a lot. Yeah. Well, on block TURBT, you know, that's a building area of knowledge. Certainly the data is not there that it provides a better operation, that it has better cure rates, that it has better staging. But I think it's something we should all, you know, I'm excited about it. I think we should watch that field evolve, that there is some engagement that on block TURBT, there's technological investment of dollars to try to make these technologies better. So instead of carving out the tumor into pieces and chips and washing them out, can you not kind of just lasso the tumor and raise it on block and lift it out as a single tumor without shattering it and kind of mutilating the tumor? I think that's an exciting field. So I think recognition that TURBT is a difficult operation and ways to maybe improve that, and on-block TURBT might be a way to make that operation a little bit more feasible and maybe a little less demanding. I think that's a nice advance. And I think you touched on many aspects of bladder cancer. I think we covered a lot of ground today. I personally thought it was great. Clinical trials, though, I think we can't avoid the fact that for learners that the field of bladder cancer management has really spiraled in a direction of clinical trials. You know, you would be lucky if there was one clinical trial every 10 years in bladder cancer. Now they're endless. And so yeah. I think keeping your eye on all of the clinical trials, the reporting out of results, I think it's important to just keep kind of a little view of what's going on in the field. I think it's important you try to keep up a little bit because the field's advancing and changing. And to be honest, the drug names are getting very hard to pronounce. Yeah. You know, you kind of want to keep up and try to be intelligent in front of your patients.
Right. You know, and it, everything, like you said, builds on it. You get one new drug. It's been researched in one environment. And then suddenly there's, you know, just a spider webbing of different trials of let's look at it in this patient population. Let's look at it combined with this drug. Let's look at it, you know, so everything just like builds exponentially on it. But I agree. Thank you so much for chatting with me. I think we've provided like a really good foundation for learners as they're learning, as they're starting to figure out, you know, what's happening in the world of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. I think this was a good place to start to get the kind of historical context so we know where the field's at now.
Great. Yeah, I appreciate the invitation again to the program. I think this is a wonderful effort, and I hope everyone benefits from listening to the podcast.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Dr. Prohar. I really appreciate it.